It's time for baking season. Well, it's always baking season, but it's also holiday season. So, to kick off baking season, let's talk fats. I'm discussing four fats: butter, lard, margarine, and shortening. This is an examination of each fat and not really a baking how-to. I've done some of those shows. So, let's get into fats. The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 216, Food and Freedom, Once a Week for Life. Hello, folks. Dan Reed here. I'm talking about fat today, so this is a good time to tell you to get fat. Get real fat with my affiliate link to Fatworks. Enter culinarylibertarian.com/getfat into your browser for real fat, which means real flavor. Fats. I want to do a show about fats, especially now that baking season is here. Specifically, I'm looking at Crisco, oleomargarine, lard, and butter. There is a ton of history about all of those, and that's for a different show. I want to cover some of that history only as it relates to market forces and innovation and advertising and culture. There's also the long-term impact on health from when Crisco was presented as a substitute for lard. Before that, it was used for candles. Let's start with butter. That's probably the oldest fat used by humans. Butter is mentioned in the Bible. One interesting tidbit I found when looking for butter information is that butter was used in Egyptian mummification. According to Elaine Khosrova, the Egyptians made a paste of butter, sawdust, and dirt, and used it, quote, to plump the skin of their mummies, end quote. To the making of butter, the origin is lost to history, but it is guessed that butter was discovered as an accident in the transporting of milk. Milk being jostled back and forth in the sacks on the back of a mule might have churned just enough on the road, and the brave tester, discovering this rather peculiar-looking lumpy thing, discovered, hey, this is pretty good. Well, that's as good a story as any about how that probably came to be. Butter comes from the butter fat in heavy cream. The butter fat part is the cream which rises to the top of the bucket when the cow is milked. Churning butter breaks up the fat globule into its constituent parts, and the fats start to stick together. As the fat molecules attract more fat molecules, they become large enough to be recognized as butter. What remains is buttermilk. Today's version of buttermilk is far removed from what is produced from making homemade butter. You can do that with a mixer and heavy cream, and it's much faster than the churn. Buttermilk produced from fresh butter is not a cultured product, and it has no acidic tang. Generally, it's pretty plain, if not maybe a touch sweet. If you've ever over-whipped whipped cream, you know what it looks like when butter molecules start to find each other. Broken whipped cream is a one-way street, so keep going. You won't have whipped cream, but you can at least make some butter. You cannot put butter globules back into the cream. I will link this whole episode as a text version on the blog, and there will be an article with a good explanation of what's going on with the fat globules there. Cream isn't exactly an emulsion. It's more like a suspension. The wee fat globules are in suspension, and the agitation on the back of a horse or in the whipping bowl or in the churn breaks that suspension to make butter. butter is an emulsion. And emulsion, remember, is the combination of two things, butter and water, fat and water, that don't generally go together well. So butter has butter fat, water, and milk protein. When the butter is melted, it separates into those different parts. The milk protein will float to the top and be like a little foam. The butter part, the butter fat part is the yellow part, which is the majority of what's in the pan, and then the water's on the bottom. Now, doing that portion is called clarifying butter. To make ghee, cook the butter on low heat until the water evaporates. The milk proteins formerly on the top will sink, and there at the bottom of the pan, they will start to caramelize in this even low heat environment. Now, if they're starting to caramelize, that means that they can burn, which for ghee, we want to avoid. When you smell a slightly nutty aroma coming off of the ghee, take it off the heat, strain it through a coffee filter into a mason jar, something glass designed to hold hot things. Don't put it in plastic. Strain it into the jar through a coffee filter to get all those little teeny brown bits out. Now, you can add those to your eggs or to the top of your bagel with cream cheese. You just don't want them in the ghee because they will continue to burn in the high heat of using ghee for cooking. But the ghee now you've gone is ready to be used. This whole explanation from starting from the heavy cream to the whipping bowl to the failed whipped cream to turning that butter into ghee is the complete life cycle of that fat globule. And it is. It's done. You can't go back. And that's, you know that part. Churning butter seems to create an image of Grandma sitting on her four-legged stool outside the barn, churning butter with the chickens pecking and scratching around her. It's a pure image and connotes wholesomeness and simplicity. The commercial butter industry is far from simple. American butter must be at least, and usually is only, 80% butter fat, 16 to 18% water, and 2 to 4% milk protein. It might be salted, which is going to be 1 to 2% salt by weight, which works out to about a quarter of a teaspoon of salt per 4-ounce stick. European butter is usually 82% butter fat. I know you're saying, 2%, big deal. It is a pretty big deal in terms of mouthfeel and consistency and plasticity of the butter. Croissants, sometimes, are made with butter that can reach 85% butter fat, and that is a huge difference. If you wonder why the grocery store bakeries, croissants, and the independent French bakery on the corner have different products, same thing, different products for different prices, the quality of the butter is one very good reason, and skill and ability is another. One site has interesting information about the kosher status of butter, and I mentioned I'm going to put this on the blog, and you can read through and find the hyperlink for that. I, like most people, including this author, would have thought that butter pretty much is just kosher as it is, right? Get the cream, make the butter, there you go. Well, not so. I'm not going to go into the details, but it is an interesting read. From kosher to treif, let's talk about lard. Lard is the rendered fat from pigs. Rendering means it is slowly melted, much like that butter to make ghee, so the pure fat remains after the rendering is done. Sometimes there are crispy bits left over, and those are hugely popular as snacks in just about every culture. I think the chicharrones or pork rinds are kind of big, and I think those are like poofed up somehow. I don't know how they do that. Those are pretty good. So Crispy bits are yummy, but we really want the pork fat. Lard will return to solid at room temperature. Since lard is pork, it will have a mild pork flavor. Lard comes in at least two, or it comes from at least two sources: fat back, or from the fat around the kidneys. Leaf lard is the fat around the kidneys, or leaf lard is from the fat that's around the kidneys and has no pork flavor. It is also perfectly ideal for baking. Leaf lard, in its mildness, has a slightly different crystalline structure. Now, we haven't talked about crystals, but all fats have them. It's relevant, and frankly, it's another show. A show probably worth doing because there's useful information about what those crystals do and how to use them to your advantage. What makes leaf lard particularly fabulous for baked goods, since this crystalline structure helps increase the flakiness of the finished product? Think fluffy biscuits and flaky pie doughs. Now, leaf lard, well, two things about leaf lard. One, you're probably not going to find it in your grocery store. You might find it in a specialty store. You definitely will find it online with the link I put at the top, the culinarylibertarian.com/getfat. They have it. The other thing about leaf lard is nobody fell into the vat in Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle. It's fiction. He made it up. As with most things done commercially, there are various levels of quality. Most grocery store lard contains both regular lard and hydrogenated lard. Now, I'm going to get into hydrogenation in a bit. Lard is easy to make at home. Not as easy to make as butter, but it's possible. Most procedures, at least the ones that I read to cut the pork fat into 1-inch cubes. Well, that seems to make sense. It's kind of small. But if you have a grinder, grind the fat through the largest grinder plate you have. More surface area means a quicker render and probably more fat coming out. That also means not really getting any cracklings. Everything comes at a cost. Crackpots are good tools for rendering the fat. Pork fat or beef fat or duck fat or goose fat or chicken fat can all be rendered for that lovely fat and those tasty cracklings. Low and slow, just like a barbecue, is the way there. Two additions that seem to be options more than necessities were offered in a few of the articles I read. One is add water. That was either recommended, not recommended, or firmly resisted, opposed, and baking soda, recommended and not even addressed at all. Its intent, according to one source, was for the preservation of the white color. If you don't have a crock pot, but do have an all-wire pasta strainer and a Dutch oven, the cleverest way I saw to render lard is to put the lard, the fat back, or the kidney fat cubes into this wire strainer, put that into your Dutch oven, and put that whole thing into a low oven. How low is low? 225 is low. Leave it in there until it's fully rendered. It may take a while, but what we do not want to have happen is get it so hot that it starts to develop a color. We don't want that to happen. Lard, finished lard, has a relatively high smoke point, which makes it really good for sautéing. Also makes it really good for donuts. Your house will probably smell like rendered pork fat. But that's how it goes. It'll go away. Put the rendered pork fat into clean jars, just like we did for a minute ago for straining it into there. And once that cools, store that in the fridge. Lard is great for sautéing, as I said, but also as a cooking vehicle itself, such as for confit. Confit is, well, you cook So duck confit is probably the most popular confit. Pork rillettes isn't confit, but it is a pork thing cooked in its own fat. Duck confit, you cure the legs with the salt, sugar, and herb and or spice mix for 12 to 24 hours. Wash that off, pat the legs dry, and then stack them into a pot. Cover them with rendered duck fat and cook them very slowly. Actually, do them in an oven too. Do them in the oven, cook them very slow, low and slow, a couple hours maybe, until a instant read thermometer or something like a skewer of a kind goes in and out of that meat easy as, well, like like something through a goose. But we want is completely super tender meat, and then take the pan out of the oven and just let the whole thing cool. And as it cools, the fat will harden, preserving those duck legs. So they never have been exposed to air once they've been cooked, and that's a preservation technique that works well for people who didn't used to have electricity. That was a little sidebar from what I wrote here. So cooking with fat, sautéing, confit, also flavor the lard as a spread for bread. There was a point in time when butter either wasn't available because you raised pigs and not cows, or there was a world war going on. So lard was a preferred spread for butters. Fatback, the thing we're going to use to make the lard, if it's not cut into 1-inch cubes, can be, it's going to be really long. So cut it into like a square, however wide it is, cut it square like that, and you can cut really, on the slicer, cut really thin pieces of it, almost like, I hate to say it, American cheese. And that is used, it's called barding. You wrap it on the outside of something that is low in fat, say a pheasant breast or a venison loin or... Well, we did pheasant. We did that for pheasant. So that's barding. You're wrapping the fat on the outside. You're tying it on there. And as it sautés and then finishes roasting in the oven, some of that pork fat's going inside the meat to help keep it moist and give it some flavor. And fatback's pretty plain as flavor goes. Pheasant is stronger than the fatback. Larding, take that same fatback and cut it into not more than 1/4 inch cubed, but long. Think of like a real, this is weird, think of like a fatback shoelace. And there's a special needle called the barding needle that holds this piece of fat. And you can kind of sew fat into venison loin, wild boar loin, something that has no fat at all. You can give it some, so as it's cooking, some of that fat melts and gives the meat a little bit of moisture that it needs, because wild game is fat-free, and cooking it past medium rare turns it into something you probably don't really want to eat. So don't overcook your fat, don't overcook your meat, and larger game. Pork fat is also a key ingredient in sausages and pâtés and into things like refried beans, as the fat in tortillas is an excellent addition into pretty much any kind of a bean soup you can make. There's just lots of ways to use pork fat to add richness and flavor to a finished dish. In that fight for fat-free eating, back in the, I guess, 90s or so, when the FDA and the USDA pushed for, pushing for this low-fat life, lard is a four-letter word. A fat-eating public, the fat-eating public, all of us are getting savvy, and that's good for our health. Yes, it is. Lard is 40% saturated fat, and butter is 54% saturated fat. Lard has no trans fats, more on that later, unless it is hydrogenated, then it has trans fats. Lard is a good source of vitamin D. Winter's coming, folks. With 100 international units of vitamin D per tablespoon compared to 9 international units in olive oil. So that alone is a good reason to load up on vitamin D, since we're not going to be getting too much sun in the winter, and vitamin D helps our health in many ways, including help lowering the risks of cancer. There are concerns in the fat-eating world about omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids, and that's beyond the scope of this episode, except to mention this part. Commercial pigs are often fed diets high in omega-6 fatty acids. If the pig eats it, and you eat the pig, you eat the fatty acids. Everything seems to be a battle. If you can find local-ish pork, buy that. If there's a pig farmer in your area, go make a new friend. Same thing goes for any of your meats, but that's not always possible, and I get that. And I promise you, Skippy the meat clerk putting the packages of meat in the grocery store cooler has no idea what that pig ate or where it came from. Again, sourcing your food is important, but not always easy. Lard has more to consider than butter. That's pretty clear. But when we look at oleomargarine, margarine nowadays, and Crisco, the issues with lard seem pretty simple. Napoleon III wanted a cheap butter substitute for his military and the French riffraff. To incentivize this research, he made it a contest to see who could be first to invent this thing. I'm going to butcher this name. Chemist Hippolyte Mégé-Maury invented oleomargarine in 1869. Ulysses S. Grant inaugurated in 1869. Mégé-Maury, whatever his name is, I'm bad at French, he combined beef fat and skimmed milk, took the butter out, to make his creation. Now, I didn't read to look at how he did it, and I'm sure that is out there. Since that time, 1869, all manner of substitutes for margarine, which is a substitute for butter, have been created, some even as perpetually liquid at room temperature form. If that sounds odd to you, there was a time, and I don't shop the margarine aisle, so I don't know, that there was a squeeze margarine product, and that just sat out on the counter all the time. In 1871, Henry W. Bradley patented a margarine which was made from cottonseed oil and animal fats. That by itself isn't relevant. In 1902, whale oil was hydrogenated and used to make margarine. Interesting, not useful by itself. Now, that's two things kind of quick. The key points, as I see them, are the use of cottonseed oil as a food and the hydrogenization of fats for edible use. I remember my grandmother talking about oleo when she used that word. It used to be the thing sold in dairy cases, and it was white instead of yellow. It came with a little packet of yellow dye, which the customer, if preferred, was to add, you mix it in or knead it in, to the oleo to make it look like butter. It turns out that the coloring was not legally allowed to be added. There were also licenses required to sell it and taxes to be paid on the selling of it. And there's a fair amount of political shenanigans going into the states that made it illegal, dairy states, to make it look like butter. It gets complicated fast, but there's a link on the text version of this blog post. During World War I, oleo sales increased because of the scarcity of dairy products. World War II saw the same demand for margarine increase for the same reason. My mother was a registered nurse back in the mid-70s, and we used margarine all the time, even that squeeze parquet. Now, I have no doubt she was doing what she thought was best based on the information she had at the time. And being in hospitals, she probably had easier access in the no computer age than most of the rest of us did. But I also know margarine was cheaper than butter. And in our house at that time, pennies mattered. If she knew then what is known now about fats and wellness, I doubt she would have continued with the margarine. And years later, she did change to extra virgin olive oil and butter, and I had influence only on the extra virgin olive oil. Ersatz butter became popular then not for the fear of trans fats. It became popular for ease and cost. The timeline gets busy quickly, but the main point is that the government mandated trans fats must be removed from margarines and nearly all foods. The scramble was on to fix those issues, and in doing so, they made a processed food a highly processed food. What could go wrong? Let's put a pin in that for a moment and talk about Crisco. There are a few impressive things about Crisco, and not one of them is Crisco. Cottonseed oil, the source of the ingredient for the original Crisco, was a pretty foul thing. Usually, cotton mills just left the seeds to rot. Chemist David Wesson invented a bleaching and deodorizing process to make this normally dark and smelly oil clear, tasteless, and odorless. Candle makers William Proctor and his brother-in-law James Gamble were up against stiff competition in Cincinnati, Ohio. By turning their focus from candles to the shortening business, they were able to circumvent the issue of the meat industry's price controls on lard and tallow, the ingredients used in their candles. Procter & Gamble bought cottonseed mills and, with the help of German chemist E.C. Kaiser, P&G developed further hydrogenation. A Weston A. Price Foundation webpage reads, quote, "By adding hydrogen atoms to the fatty acid chain, this revolutionary industrial process transformed liquid cottonseed oil into a solid that resembled lard," end quote. Crisco, an acronym for crystallized cottonseed oil, was introduced to the market in 1911. That's impressive thing one, taking trash and making it useful. As candles, it was probably better, but electricity was coming everywhere, and candles weren't the necessity they used to be. Cottonseed oil shortening was not a new idea at the time, and not a new idea for baking. But Procter & Gamble changed the game. With clever circular logic and divining the thing with the thing, Crisco was Crisco, they circumvented that crowded market of cottonseed shortenings by advertising this product as being cheaper than butter and is more pure because it's shortening. A January 1913 ad in the Ladies' Home Journal ad reads in part, quote, "Cake made with Crisco retains its original fine, soft texture. Crisco contains no water. It is all shortening. Butter is almost one-fifth water. Crisco is pure vegetable and is a far richer shortening than butter," end quote. TheConversion.com has a page about Crisco, and the author writes, quote, "Crisco marketers offered only evasion and euphemism. Crisco was made from 100% shortening. Its marketing materials asserted, and Crisco was Crisco, nothing else. Sometimes they gestured toward the plant kingdom. Crisco was strictly vegetable, purely vegetable, or absolutely all vegetable," end quote. That's impressive thing number two, connecting cotton seeds to vegetables. They seem to be one of the first to do that, and the idea has stuck. Impressive thing number three is marketing. Procter & Gamble published a cookbook for free for Crisco, with Crisco as the fat of choice in all the recipes. Very savvy. Impressive thing number four, trust the brand, not the ingredients. Crisco sold very well for a long time and no one knew what it was. But it came from modern processing and science and it was so white it had to be pure and safe, right? Now, Crisco is replaced with soy, palm, and canola oils. It is still hydrogenated and it is still highly processed. One main issue with Crisco was the trans fats. They had to make changes when the government got tough on those. Let's take a moment out for a word from Jake about his Tasting Anarchy podcast.
Hey everyone, Jake here, host of the Tasting Anarchy podcast. Join my co-host Mason and I each week as we explore the world of wine and alcohol through a Liberty lens. You can find us on all your major podcatchers, tastinganarchy.com or Tasting Anarchy on Twitter. Tasting Anarchy, your wine and liberty podcast. Find out how much government is in your drink.
Trans fats are terrible for us. Do you know how I know that? The government said so. Page after page after page of reading for this episode, I kept bumping into how terrible trans fats are and how they cause diabetes and insulin resistance and heart disease. It's almost consensus science, and not one time did any of them cite a source or explain how trans fats do the terrible things they do. They just do, okay? Trust the science. I started down the trans fat rabbit hole and found confusion and discord and consensus. To sort it out and make it simple, I asked biochemist Kyle Mamonis about trans fats and why are they bad. Kyle's response was, he's not certain they really are all that bad. And fats and sugars is one of Kyle's areas of focus. Trans fats is still discussed the same way saturated fats are, incorrectly, discussed, and the same way, also incorrectly, sodium is discussed. They are discussed by hanging on to old science and old information to keep fear up and resistance low. And if you look on the Google, it probably works. Nearly every page has some disclaimer, many of them the exact same one, citing the FDA and or the CDC about fats and how important it is to minimize them and focus on seed oils. Mostly missing in all of those discussions is sugar. One other key issue from those fats is cholesterol. We've been told there are good and bad cholesterols, and that 200 is the magic number, and if you exceed that, well, here's a handful of pills. Like saturated fat and sodium, the cholesterol narrative has been blown up, in part by the likes of Ivor Cummins. The key issue with Crisco, and probably other shortenings, is the seed oil. Vegetables don't have oil. Corn is a grain. Avocado is a seed, and olives are a fruit, and peanuts are legumes. Carrots don't have oil, at least not enough to make virgin cold-pressed carrot oil. Asparagus is a grass. But they're vegetation. I'm sure they're vegetation. The fact that they're vegetation doesn't make them vegetables any more than my dog being some sort of partially sentient being makes him a human. Trans fats is a good episode idea, and I'm going to investigate that, but it's going to take some serious amount of reading to see if I can even make heads or tails out of this, because it seems to be changing rapidly. What seems plain enough over more than 100 years of shortening is stick to the foods that Granny ate and that Granny made. Meat, vegetables in season, butter and lard and tallow. Tallow's the same thing as lard with beef. And duck fat. Local meats if you can find them. Online meats if local isn't possible, and if fundage is possible. Funds is a big issue, especially now. It seems nearly every neighborhood has a few people raising chickens. Go make friends and buy some eggs. Buy fresh eggs. The lady who grows eggs, grows chicken, anyway, whatever. The lady who sells me her eggs, $3 a dozen. It's five and change, $6 for 18 in the store, and who knows? What the yolks are barely yellow. The whites, they run and they run and they run. I don't know how many weeks they've been in the shell, in the case, waiting for me to pick it up. When I buy them from the lady who calls me, I'm going to be there today or tomorrow. That's a fresh egg. This episode covered a lot. We learned about butter, lard, margarine, and shortening. Butter and lard are minimally processed. Yes, they're processed foods. And margarine and shortening are highly processed foods. In addition to that, butter and lard have pretty simple ingredients, and margarine and shortening have many ingredients, some not simple, and very complex processes for making them. Foods as close to their natural state are better foods to eat because it's closer to what food is in nature. All right, folks, that's going to do it. I will put the blog post for this episode, and you'll see a lot of the hyperlinks going to articles related to the portion that follows for some of the sources that I consulted for information for this episode. That will also give you a chance to check me. Don't believe me. Go find your own information. It's there. There are scores of rabbit holes to explore, and every one of those links has more at the bottom. It just goes and goes and goes. That's the door. I'm just showing you where it is. I want to thank you very much for listening. I appreciate you being here. It means a lot to me. It means a lot to me also for the Patreon supporters who are here every week. You can join the Patreon supporters with the link on the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/support. This episode doesn't have a chef's table, and in real time from last week, I'm behind on getting my pot of shoe up. So, yes, I know. In 6 months, this won't make any sense, but I'm acknowledging my behindness. But you can join the Patreon supporters and get all the chef tables from the guests when I print them up. And in the rather slowly coming out, other bonus content. For your baking pleasure and your aunt's baking pleasure who doesn't listen, share this episode on your social media feeds so she knows what's going on, and kindly direct her away from the Crisco and point her in the direction of leaf lard or butter. It's going to work out better. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.